Welcome again. It's like your 12th welcome. I know you feel so welcomed at this point. We're fasting also. So throughout Lent, we're doing a fast that's leading up to Holy Week and our Easter celebration. We're doing it in two ways. One is once a week, we're calling all of us as a community to fast from food, from a breakfast and a lunch, and then break it with dinner with your community group, or if not with your group, with your family or with friends or with whoever. And there's a guide that comes out each week, like a meditation. But then we're also fasting in another way, that we're collectively, essentially quieting different parts of our life. Because as a culture, we've added so much noise. I think I said it in the Lenten meditation this past Wednesday, that there was a study that came out last summer that said the average American listens to, or is consumes like 11 hours and 20 minutes of media a day. So we've just filled the whole thing with noise, essentially, from wake up to shutdown. So we're quieting the different parts of our day. So we quieted the car for a while. We quieted the devices throughout the day. We quieted the mornings this last week. We quieted the evenings. This week, we're taking on something new. So it isn't like a cumulative sort of nature. So it isn't like by the end you're a monk. So we're giving the things back. But it's been interesting to quiet the different parts of my own life, and even hearing stories of friends do it as well. And there's different realizations and different connections with the Holy Spirit and different sort of awakenings and reawakenings that are happening, which are exciting. We're moving towards a three-day fast together as a community from food on Holy Week. So that's next week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and we're going to break it with the Good Friday. So part of the food fasting that we've been doing is intentionally putting ourselves in a rhythm to move towards doing this three-day fast together. So you've been in like a training, if you've been participating in it, preparing yourself to go into a three-day fast together. And next week we'll get into more of the details of that, of what that looks like, how do we head into it, how do we prepare. But this is the week where these two things are all going to kind of align and begin to merge together. So what we're going to quiet this week, the fast that we're taking on, is that we're removing alcohol, sugar, and caffeine. The things, the grunting things. So if you were to do a three-day fast, I'll start there, there are withdrawals that come with removing, depending upon your alcohol consumption, alcohol, but also sugar and caffeine. And if you try to pull all that at once and just jump into a three-day fast, some people did that last year and the year before, and they were just really angry, upset people. With me, with themselves, with God and the universe. And it wasn't a pleasurable fasting experience. You would want to get off of those things way early on as you're preparing yourself to enter into a three-day fast so that it is a space where you're more present and connected to what you're doing. So this is part of that. So this week, the quieting is essentially the things that we go to sort of food-wise that we bring into our life. Like, you wake up in the morning, I'm exhausted, I wasn't sleeping right, I'm just going to drink more caffeine. I'm going to have another cup of coffee. Oh, I'm tired in the afternoon, I'm going to add another one to it. Or in the evening, you're like, I'm so stressed out, I'm going to have a glass of wine, I'm just going to calm down so I can just kind of be present with my family. If when we pull those things, it just, there's no more substances allowing you to come up and down to meet the spaces of the day. Or the sugar, when you're like, oh, stressful moment, I'm like, Skittles, bam, the either peanut M&Ms or purple Skittles. To the point where one of my staff members came in to tell me that they were getting ready to transition off the team a few years ago. They were a part-time employee, and they showed up with a bag of peanut M&Ms and a bag of purple Skittles and put them on the desk. I'm like, oh no. What are you going to tell me right now? But she knew I was going to need that for the conversation, so it was obvious with my staff that I, what? Oh, more candy. And so there's things that we use to cope effectively with emotions and with the realities of the day. So I'm inviting you this week to remove those things as we're heading towards a fast next week, but also then to be more present with the feelings and emotions that come and to present them before God. So if you're reaching for whatever to cope, that's a moment when you can like turn and you can stop and you can reach towards the Spirit and say, whoa, what is this thing that I'm sensing, that I'm feeling right now, God? And kind of bring it before the Spirit and ask. And it is a really sweet space to do it. If you're trying to transition off caffeine and you drink a lot of caffeine, I'm going to recommend this week is like a taper week. So take off the afternoon first, then kind of take off the third cup in the morning. You're going to want to ease into the second cup in the morning, down to a single cup, maybe even a half cup, depending. Some of you guys may need a cup of decaf after that. All the way down, because your capillaries in your brain that have been so constricted from the caffeine will suddenly reopen. It is quite a painful experience, from experience. Trust me. You don't want to do that. So I would encourage it in that sense. So this week, we're fasting together collectively one day on Wednesday from a meal, but we're also removing those things that we use to cope: alcohol, sugar, caffeine. Sound good? Some of you guys already are monks, and you're like, well, that's easy. I'm already doing it. Well, congratulations. We're all trying to join you. Okay, and then next week, we'll dig more into what that fast looks like and how we prepare for it. But truthfully, this whole thing has been a preparing process of all of Lent towards that experience together. So you don't sweat it. You're already in it. We're taking you along. So we're going through a series called Kingdom Society. If you don't have a Bible, could you raise your hand and we can bring some Bibles around? And we are breaking it up into movements. And the whole idea is, if Jesus has initiated his kingdom in his death and resurrection, and he's going to come back and finish it, but he invites us to participate in it now, how do we become like a kingdom people? How do we become a people that actually live into and become the people of Jesus that he describes in the scriptures? And so we're sort of setting it up in movements towards that end. We talked about gospel, we talked about kingdom, we've talked about spirit, and now we're talking about embodiment. And the idea of embodiment is Jesus says, not blessed are you if you hear these things in the Sermon on the Mount, but blessed are you if you do them, right? It's the idea that he says in John 20:21, now I'm sending you out into the world the same way the Father sent me. It's the idea of discipleship, which is being with Jesus to become like Jesus so we can do the things that Jesus is doing in the world. We're his body, so how do we actually embody this resurrection life and the life of the kingdom and the gospel that he invites us to? And so, because that's quite a big subject, talking about living into a rhythm of discipleship, we're breaking it up into different steps within the movement. So we're starting with relationships. So we're talking about whole relationships. And we're going to spend some time there. But if we're going to talk about what it is to be kingdom people in regards to our relationships, it probably has to start with like a real base level. Like, how are we even entering into a baseline understanding of being in relationship with each other? What does that even look like? And so for that, turn to Luke chapter 9, verse 46. Luke 9:46. An argument started among the disciples as to which of them would be the greatest. It happens all the time in my house. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and made him stand beside them. Then he said to them, whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me, for it is the one who is least among you all who is the greatest. Don't you find it interesting that as human beings, we often think that we're better than everybody else, right? Or at least that we're entitled to something. I find that fascinating. Years ago, I worked at a church before we planted this church, and that church had stickers, kind of like our church has stickers, of the church. It's more of like a mystery brand, just an R with a circle around it, so if you know, you know. And if you don't know, you better know. It's happening, right? This one just said the name of the church on it. And I remember driving down the freeway in this town that I lived in, and this car was coming wildly in the rearview mirror, and it came behind, and it kind of swerved around me, and somebody else was trying to change lanes at the same time, and it like honked at them and then cut them off and then threw a one-finger salute like that out the window of the car. And I'm like, oh, and I looked, and there's a sticker on the back of the window, and it was the name of our church, like really big on there, and I was like, I was like mortified, right? I'm like, you're giving us a bad name, and I was all mad about it. Like, that guy thinks he has the right to drive wherever he wants and cut anybody off, and it's his. I was all mad. And then, like, a couple weeks ago, I was driving. And I've got, like, a big cargo van that I drive as my daily. And I was going to get on the freeway. That was a couple months ago. here in town, I also have a sticker on my car that is it's an R with a circle around it. And as I was going to get on, there's some of the freeway on-ramps are two, and then they merge into one. And I was going, and I was up first. It was clearly my run. And this person came behind me in like a brand new, real shiny sports car. And they came flying up behind me, and they were like all over the tail of my van, and they were honking. And then they like swerved, and it was like as the things were merging together, and they just like gassed it to get around me so fast that I had to swerve over into the shoulder, and they like cut me off and kind of honked as they went by, and something in me snapped, and I was like, that's it! And I just, like, I lost it, and I floored it as hard as I could. I'm going to chase this man down, and I'm going to tell him what I think through the window. I was raging, and my car's all, blup, 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 blup. And he's like, vroom, like he's just gone down the freeway, and then I was one exit, so I exited off, and I'm like, whoo, whoo, whoo. I'm like trying to rev it down on the way into staff meeting, like, calm down, calm down, calm down. And I realized, oh, well, I'm just like that other guy. I'm the same. It's almost like the sense of entitlement's in all of us, which is interesting when it revs up and you don't see it coming. So Jesus is with his disciples, and they've been together for a while. And they've seen Jesus do a lot of stuff. They've seen him perform miracles. They've seen him heal people from all kinds of chronic illnesses and demon possessions. They've seen him raise people from the dead at this point in the journey. They see him as their great teacher and a prophet. And they've just come to see him as their Messiah. So just right before this, Jesus says, who do you think that I am? And Peter eventually says, you're the Messiah. And Jesus says, you're right. The Spirit told you that. And the idea that they're coming to see Jesus as their Messiah is really crucial to understanding what's going on in this passage. That they now see him as their Messiah. And you have to understand just a little bit of the history of the Jewish people to understand what's going on in their mind and in their psyche as they're having this argument of where they're trying to position themselves alongside Jesus, because it shapes what's actually going on in them. So we've talked about it fairly often. So I'll give you the fast version. In Genesis 12, God tells Abraham that he's going to bless him and give him descendants like the stars, and through them they're going to be a blessing to the entire world. And so God sets out this plan through the Jewish people. He's going to redeem and restore the entire world, and that's essentially the story of the Jewish people. But they fail to do so continuously, and God tells them if they don't live up to their end of the covenant, he'll eventually allow pagan nations to come in and destroy them and exile them. Through the prophets, he says this to them. In 587 BC, the Babylonians come, and they crush them despite all the warnings, and they take whoever's left off into exile. Then after that, the Persians come in, and they let some of them go home, but they sort of continue to crush them. And then after that, just nation after nation conquered them. Alexander the Great, then when he died, all of his generals took turns just kind of beating them up, taking turns conquering this people, and then eventually all the way down to the Romans when we get to the time of Jesus. So for like 600 years, they've just been kicked around. And that's their story, is that they were a beaten people at that time. But during that process, God was speaking to them and said, man, I'm still going to uphold my plan, and I'm still going to bless you, and through you I'm going to bless the whole world, and there's going to be a transformation that happens. There's going to be a giant sort of redemption, and it's going to happen through a Messiah, which just means an anointed one. So when we're talking about the Messiah, it's the one that's the answer to 600 years of hard crushing. And the hope and the promise of the Messiah, this anointed one, would be the long-awaited king of Israel that would be from the line of David, that would effectively liberate God's people in the exile, defeat evil, bring justice and mercy to the earth, and kick out all the pagan nations and reestablish them as like God's people in the land again. And that would bring justice and mercy throughout the entire world. And the Messiah would effectively be the king, but also the high priest, the king who establishes the kingdom in that sense, but the high priest simultaneously that actually restores the people to their relationship with God and forgives the sins and brings the people back in. Like restores relationship and then reestablishes the kingdom. Fight off God's enemies, gather God's people. This is like the long-awaited plan. And the catch, though, is how the people thought it would happen, because the people thought the Messiah would just do what all the rest of the nations were doing, because that was the norm. They've had their butt kicked for 600 years, and they're like, when the Messiah comes, it's all coming back on you guys. Like, they're waiting for that to throw down, like an iron fist violence war, because it's the people that have been beaten down for 600 years, and they're ready for God to do something to defeat the nations and bring it all back, right? And this is the point in the story when the disciples said, "You're the Messiah." And Jesus is like, "You're right." So all that's in their head right now. Like all of that is underneath the surface. And imagine what would come naturally in this group of disciples. He's gathered 12 of them. They represent the 12 tribes of Israel. They're looking down the line. Like if Jesus is gathering an army and we're going to take back, like these guys are at the front. And so they essentially are picturing Jesus defeating the Roman Empire, rebuilding the temple, restoring the nation, bringing justice and mercy to the land. Like all of that stuff. And they think that he's sort of coming with an iron fist to take care of business. And they're like rallying behind him. They're getting his back. And that's where the argument would develop. Who would be greatest in this kingdom? Like if he's setting up court, who's going to be with him at his right and who's going to be with him at his left? In the Gospel of Matthew, it actually says, who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Which is, I think they're doing what you and I would do. I think they're doing what most anybody would do. They're thinking it through because if Jesus is the Messiah and we're following him and he's going to take the world by force, he's the new kingdom, there's a new kingdom, then who's going to be with him at his right and his left? They're like putting themselves in place ahead of time. And Jesus does something really weird. He senses they're fighting, because remember, they're not even asking him yet. They're fighting with each other, and he sees what's happening. And he sort of interrupts it, and he takes a child, a small child, and pulls it up next to him. And he says, whoever receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is least among you is the one who's greatest. In Mark's account of the exact same story, it says, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. In Matthew's version, it says, unless you turn and actually become like these children, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child, he's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Now, I don't know about you, but that's a weird answer on Jesus' part. If you think about everything else, I mean, we're used to that answer because if you've ever been at church before, you've heard this stuff. You're like, yeah, he did the child thing, you know? Become like a child. It's like a classic Jesus thing. But this is the first time he said it. It wasn't a classic Jesus thing yet. It was the first Jesus thing that he did. Like, that's weird. Unless you realize the place of children in this world of the Roman Empire at the time. It's not that strange at all. And I'm not talking about Judaism. I'm talking about the Roman Empire that's in control. See, children were important for the security of humanity, obviously, and community and the family. But the Roman people viewed children as like particularly vulnerable and weak, and like physically weak, and even mentally weak. And the world of the empire lived under a shadow of just too many mouths to feed, which was like a significant problem, which meant that children were often abandoned and exposed to die. It was common in Greek and Roman culture and life. It was called infanticide. It was quite common. Abortion was too dangerous at that time to the mother, so more frequently newborn children were just exposed to die. And Greek and Roman people like went further than a lot of people at that time did, because the father in a Roman culture was the paterfamilias. He had all power and all control, even death over his own family, life and death. That a father had the power to declare if a newborn child would live or would die. And the way that the society worked was that a child wasn't considered part of a family until a father said it was. So if a child was born, the father had the power to decide through a religious ceremony that this child is now a living part of our family or isn't. And if they decide that it's not, then the child would be exposed. And they didn't consider exposure of children murder. They just considered it like a refusal to admit to society. It's wild, right? And there's a piece of papyrus from 1 BC recovered in Egypt. There's a father named Hilarion writing to his wife. He says, I beg and entreat you, care of the little one, and as soon as we receive our pay, I'll send it up to you. If by chance you bear a child, if it's a boy, let it be. If it's a girl, expose it. So it's common. This is what I'm saying. This is the view of children at the time, which means in Roman culture, children took one of the lowest places in society. And when Jesus' followers are fighting about who's the greatest, he says, you got to become like a child. Think about that. It's even more stark. He says, you have to become like a child. You have to become like the lowest in society. And Matthew says, Jesus said, And if you don't, you will never know what the kingdom is. That's wild. So the Messiah is obviously doing things really differently than was expected, right? Than what the people thought. He was establishing a kingdom, but it looked really, really different. He wasn't going to Jerusalem to conduct beatdowns. He wasn't going to Jerusalem to gather the army and slaughter the pagans. He wasn't building an army to establish even a political kingdom, because his kingdom was bigger than that. He was more interested in God's bigger promise of restoring the entire world, which means political boundaries could never hold his kingdom. And God's plan to restore this world that began in Jesus and his kingdom, it has finally arrived in Jesus, and he says you couldn't be part of it unless what? Unless you could fight and were ready to do battle, unless you were really theologically well-trained and you could argue yourself better than others on the finer points of theology, or you could preach good sermons, or unless you were a pastor, or unless you were the most religious. Only after you die and go to heaven. Or he says, unless you lower yourself now in this life. That's wild. Even to the point where he says, the least among you is actually the greatest. It's like the whole thing for Jesus is upside down. The whole idea of the kingdom is absolutely upside down to the way our culture and our society works. See, because when Jesus spoke of his kingdom, he says it's here and it's begun. And he says, follow him and join this kingdom movement. But where does he say that he's going as you're following him? He's going to a cross to redeem and restore people's souls, to restore the relationship with God, to restore people's lives. And the scriptures speak of the fact that God is in this process of redeeming the entire world and creation and cosmos even. And as we become followers of Jesus, as we put our trust in him, we're invited to follow him and his kingdom movement of redeeming the world, but it's upside down. Jesus says follow him, but his life was leading to the cross. It's this sort of kingdom way of overcoming evil with love. It's radically different. It's the way of redeeming humanity, but through service. The way of following Jesus is so different than what comes naturally to us as people, especially as our culture and our society today. It's upside down. Or maybe it's right side up, and our just whole world is upside down. And Jesus is coming to expose that. There's a famous author named Henry Nouwen, and he wrote a ton on the spiritual life. And he coined these two terms that have really stuck with me over the years. One is upward mobility, and the other is downward mobility. So he speaks of upward mobility and downward mobility. And I think you could easily define our culture and our world now by our American society by an idea of upward mobility. Our whole life and way of life is completely obsessed with the idea of climbing a ladder of success and actually making it to the top. I mean, you can see it in everything. You can see it in our houses, in our jobs, in our cars, in our incomes, in our Netflix shows, in our news media feeds, in like our politics and our social media, and especially in our churches, right? We want the biggest and the best. We have to be successful. We have to conquer knowledge and people. We have to strive to wield influence and be successful. We're a culture that feels this insatiable need to climb the ladder of success. I mean, the driving political mantra of the current administration capitalized off of this. Make America great again. We're going to start winning again. It's based on like the entire identity of a culture that's entirely based in upward mobility, right? Our whole society sort of lives this way. We're Americans. This is the land of kicking butt and taking names. This is the land of the self-made man and woman. This is what our culture is. This is the air that we breathe. I remember, this is going to date me greatly. The first time it really became aware to me that I resonated deeply with the idea that you need to do anything necessary to win and get on top. Do you guys remember the show 24? It's like, I think this is the beginning of binge watching TV shows. It was a show about a guy named Jack Bauer who was like a American anti-terrorist officer, I guess. He's like Special Forces guy who became a Los Angeles anti-terrorist cop, basically. And he apparently had the freedom to do whatever he wanted. And the show is somehow, I think there's like 10 seasons where some massive, like he saved the world 10 times. And it's amazing. It only took 10 days. Because each show is based in a 24-hour period. There's 24 shows, so it's real time. It's an hour. So it starts at whatever time, and it's going to go all the way around for 24 hours, and Jack Bauer always wins. But I remember, like, we got hooked. We were way hooked because we were given the box set of DVDs, different time. 4 episodes on a DVD, and it would just start. Like, the next show, you didn't have to choose the next show. You had to choose not to watch the next show. It was a different time. We would watch all 4 every night until we finished the thing. It was amazing. And we got lost, but I remember in season 2, there was this moment where there's some kind of terrorist threat. Jack's got to save the world. Yes, we understand. But there's a moment when he needed to go undercover to get involved in some gang that was going to lead him towards his next step to infiltrating some terrorist cell because he needed to save the world. And he's got this guy in this interrogation room that he brings in, and he's like interrogating the guy, and then he realizes the gang wants this guy really bad. And in the middle of the interrogation, he just like looks at him, he pulls out his gun, he shoots the guy and drops him dead at the conference table in front of the other cops. The other cops are like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "You wanna see things get done in this world, but you don't have what it takes to get it done." He's like, "You need to roll up your sleeves." And he looks at the guy, he's all, "I'm gonna need a hacksaw." Cuts his head off, throws it in a bag. He's all, "Call the chopper," jumps on a plane, takes the head to the gang and gets in, and he's going, now he's one step closer to infiltrating the terrorist unit. And I remember thinking, oh my God, like at first I was freaking out, oh my gosh, what's happening? And then I'm like, I thought about it that night as I was going to bed, I'm like, but he needed to do it. Yeah, actually, it was necessary. I mean, people are gonna get dirty if we're gonna get things done. Like, oh, like somehow like everyone was applauding it at that time and I was a part of it. And it's insane now we're a few years out. But nothing's changed. Like, it was a post-9/11 fear-driven sort of world, and we're like, if that's what it took to end this terrorist crisis. Like, that was the collective sort of consciousness of what was going on. But, man, you follow all the shows that come after that. You look at all the Denzel movies of revenge and violence, Man on Fire, Equalizer, Equalizer 2, maybe Equalizer 3 if we're lucky, you know? Like, John Wick, they killed his puppy, so he's got to kill everybody. And they invented gun-fu as like a new method of wiping out humanity, because if we will do anything that it takes to win, right? That's our consciousness. That's our consciousness as a people. And I'm not knocking the idea of ambition. I'm not knocking the idea of progress or success or defense. But what I'm talking about is the idea that genuine Christianity is something different than an uncontrolled drive for upward mobility, in which making it to the top actually becomes its own goal, and ambition no longer serves a bigger ideal. There's a profound difference between a false ambition for power and authority and success in its own right, and a true ambition for love and service and lifting others up and pouring yourself out for the healing of others and the healing of the world. It's the difference between trying to raise yourself up and trying to lift other people up. Progress is great, and success can be fantastic. Ambition can be a really good thing, but for what? The problem isn't in the desire for development and progress as an individual in a community. The problem is when you make the drive for success into your religion and then you stamp it with the name of Jesus. That's different. And it's not just our culture, and it's not just our nation, it's not just our town, it's not just our driving, it's not just our Netflix. We didn't invent this. I think it's gone on since the beginning of Christianity. It has. It's gone on from the very beginning, like across the history of the followers of Jesus from the very beginning. The disciples fighting over who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom. After Jesus is gone and he sends them out to the whole world, including the Gentiles by name, they leave the Gentiles out in their own sort of quest for progression in the kingdom in the way that they saw it and their sort of expediency in that moment. We see it in 1,000 different ways. There's been millions of people murdered over the last 2,000 years in the name of Jesus in the pursuit of power and authority, in the pursuit of success, right? The Romans post-Constantine, the Crusades, the Inquisition, the missionary conquest into the Americas, kings and queens and military leaders, even those like Hitler, who started a lot of his early campaigning on the platforms of churches in Germany. It's happened again and again and again. Governments proclaiming Christian principles and morals while using gross amounts of violence. Churches and pastors of churches seeking to be celebrities and get rich and sort of seeking greatness and power and authority, even down to us as individuals just forsaking the call of Jesus to achieve power and authority in the pursuit of success in our own lives. You can do that. You can do all that. Just don't call it Christian. Don't call it Jesus. You know what I mean? How many times do we wish to be important and powerful and loved and cherished and to succeed and to be on top and would be willing to do almost anything to get it? And your job, how you treat your coworkers, your boss, your clients, your success, and your family, how you treat your spouse or your children, your extended family, and your dating, how you treat the people that you're dating or in your relationships, just in your everyday life. How many times have you climbed over someone else to get recognized or rolled somebody else under the bus to get out of something or pushed yourself to the front to get what you want, to get on top? How much of our lives is about us and selfishness and doing whatever it takes to get what I want, to be who I want, to build myself up in whatever context that I have to, that I live in? How many times have you jumped in front of the people in the grocery store aisles to be the first or cut people off or yelled at him in our driving, or tried, but your car's too slow. But I still yelled. Or just been rude and lame to employees and people in restaurants or stores because they didn't serve you the way that you wanted. Or in our shopping, or in our sports, or in our politics. When I, in undergrad, I studied psychology, and in our psychology program, they truly graded, not everything, but a lot of the classes on a bell curve. And a true bell curve grading system means that, like, it has to be broken down that only so many people can get A's, so many people can get B's, so many people can get C's. Like, there's a curve that everything has to sort of spread out on, which means if you all get an A, you don't all get an A. Like, it still spreads out. You can get an A in the class, but you still have a C because of the way that the whole performance of the class spelled out. And I remember some of the students in my class, when we'd be studying together, they would intentionally give wrong answers in study groups to other people because it wasn't enough just to do good for yourself. Others had to do poorly so that you would do well. Oh, that's the world we live in. Everyone, what about our prayer life? How many of our prayers could be attempts to manipulate God into doing what you want to get what you want, how you want it, and how many times you get God when he does it? How many times you get mad at God when he doesn't do it the way that you wanted him to? Or even the idea of, like, well, we're killing it, so God must be blessing us. I mean, dang, look at this success. Clearly God's behind this. Imagine if everyone, like Hitler, would be like, dang, I mean, God must be behind me because we've taken another nation and another nation, right? Like, if you applied that logic across the board with how that would work. It's as if we can miss it and turn the whole idea of success and being on top into, like, real Christianity and never fully grasp what Jesus says his kingdom's actually about. I really have heard people say over and over again, I got that promotion because I've been faithful, and now God's blessed me because of it. Or our church is growing and getting this and having this kind of success because God's blessed us, and that is a sign of his blessing, that success, right? It's as if we think we're entitled to moving up the ladder of success as Christians, as if we think that's what it actually means to be blessed by God. But Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit. And he says things like, blessed are the meek. And Paul says things like, he's content with little and he's content with much, whether he's hungry or whether he's full. And the disciples were radically faithful, all 12, all the way through their own martyrs, most of them. And God stood with them and blessed them all the way through. And it was their death and their martyrdom that was said the blood of the martyrs was the seed of the saints. It was their martyrdom that actually catalyzed the church into its growth. It was quite the opposite. This way of being a follower of Jesus and participating in his kingdom, it's really different. It's the opposite. Now it speaks of a downward mobility. It's an entirely different approach than what comes naturally to us. And the disciples did too. The whole time they were following him, they were missing it. They're missing it from day one. Jesus came to be a servant, and he came to die on a cross. And throughout the Gospels, you can read this underlying theme taking place. He knows where he's going from the very beginning. The rest of those who are with him don't, which is the problem. From the moment he begins to reveal to the disciples that he's the Messiah, he also says, and now I have to suffer and I have to die and rise from the dead. This theme comes out. And it says things like they were odd. Like if you read through Luke's Gospel, it's this constant theme. Everything is based around the fact that he's going to Jerusalem to die on a cross. All the travel narratives, he's on his way to Jerusalem and this is happening. He's moving towards Jerusalem and this is happening. It says Jesus steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem, and it describes all the things he was willing to set aside to head to Jerusalem. His face was set to the journey to Jerusalem because everything about it was going to the cross to die. And his disciples were invited in on that journey. He was on a mission from day one, and the mission was the cross. The mission was the cross, and the disciples continued to miss it. They actually challenged him, and Jesus was like, get behind me, Satan. You don't understand where this thing is going. You don't get it. They wanted to dominate, and they wanted to be on top. And as they were drawing near, James and John didn't just argue any longer about who would be the first in the kingdom. Because remember, at the beginning, in Luke's version, they're fighting amongst themselves. No one's actually addressing Jesus in this sense. By the time we get here in Matthew 20, they're actually seeking it out directly to get positions of grandeur and power and authority in the kingdom. Well, sort of. They sent their mom to ask him. Look at Matthew 20, verse 20. It says, then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and kneeling down asked a favor of him. Classic. Will you give me whatever I ask, Jesus? He's like, what do you want? Literally. What is it that you want? He asked. She said, grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom. You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said to them. Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink? We can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right and left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they've been prepared by my Father. And when the ten heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Jesus called them together and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them, but not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus tells them when they want the two seats that it's not for them to have. The people on his right and left, he says the Father set aside who that would be when he came into his kingdom. But notice where they were. They were hanging on crosses at his right and at his left when he established his kingdom. And now the other disciples got angry and they were frustrated that James and John had come in and would ask for such a thing. And at first when I read this, I thought they were angry like because they were so holy. Like they were in shock. How could James and John ask such a question in an upside down kingdom? These guys, amateur hour in the discipleship group again. I don't think it was like that. I think more likely they were angry because they beat them to it. I think they were like, what? And you got your mom in there? Like they beat them. Like they all wanted the power and authority because they had the same misconceptions that we do. But Jesus had an entirely different plan in the works. Whoever wants to become great must be your servant. Whoever wants to be great among you must be your slave. He says, for I didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give my life as a ransom for many. Which means it's backwards in how we think. It's upside down. There's another place in the scripture Jesus says, the first will become last, and the last will become first. The one who's the greatest servant will be the greatest in the kingdom. That's why the rest of the New Testament picks up on this, and it spells it out in so many different ways. Look at Philippians chapter 2, verse 3. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interest of the others. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who, being in the very nature of God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death. Even death on a cross. Have the same mindset in you that's in Christ Jesus. Or in the book of Romans, In chapter 14, it can speak of this reality of all the freedom that comes in knowing Christ and the liberation that comes from it, yet the need to put the needs of others above yourself if you're going to be part of the kingdom, even to the point where you would limit your own freedoms for the sake of the weaker brother and sister, is this wild theme that breaks out, which is just an understanding of how we live it out together in community. Or even if you look at Ephesians chapter 5, verse 21, he says, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. It isn't even a hierarchical thing. It's a mutual submission. It's a constant mutual submission amongst his people to each other, like a constant deferment to the other. And if everyone lives that way, everyone's being lifted up and everyone's being empowered and cared for. It's why in another place in the scripture, Jesus says, if you want to follow him, then pick up your cross and follow him. It's what Christine talked about last week. It's a life of service and love and downward mobility. When Jesus washed his disciples' feet afterwards, he said, if I, then your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I've given you an example that you should also do as I've done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is the one who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, said Jesus, then blessed are you if you do them. Jesus didn't say, blessed are you if you know them. He didn't say, blessed are you if you take really good notes on these things. He didn't say, blessed are you if you teach and preach these things. He said, blessed are you if you do them. Happiness and power are ironic things, that the more we chase them, the more that they elude us. But when you start to give them away, they actually sneak up on you. What if instead of simply trying to make yourself successful, what if we tried making other people successful? What would that actually look like in our lives? Or what if we viewed the success an ambition that we've been given by God as like stewardship, something that we would steward for the sake of other people? And what I'm not talking about is becoming like a self-made martyr, like the kind of person that uses the impression of being the least so that they'll be, like if you're like playing the game, you're like, what? So the person on bottom is actually the one who's important here. Okay, got it. Like I know how to win. Like that's really like, that's like a twisted up, messed up attempt at getting on top. Please don't do that. It's really ugly, and it's usually really apparent, and if it's not, it's even more ugly. So don't do that. I'm also not talking about becoming a doormat that gets kicked around, that doesn't have any kind of self-esteem or respect. I'm not talking about getting taken advantage of. I'm not talking about giving up. There's a fine line between living an upside-down kingdom of God kind of life and being taken advantage of, and there's a difference. There's a difference. But Jesus said he didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And he calls us to follow him. He invites us to be his body, to be his ambassadors to the world. And when you follow Jesus, it's upside down. It's where the least is the greatest and the last is the first. And it's the kind of life God always intended us to have. It creates a different kind of people when you're mutually submitted to each other and you're committed to the success and flourishing of others around you. It creates a whole different kind of world. It's the kind of life and community that actually restores humanity at all levels and ushers in God's will on earth as it is in heaven. It's the kind of life that partners with God in his plan of restoring everything. It turns everything on its head. It forces us to rethink like every facet of our daily lives, because the kingdom's here and the kingdom is happening and it's all around you. But it's different than we think. It's upside down. It's counterintuitive. And so the question is, do you have the eyes to see and the ears to hear? And will you actually join Jesus in his kingdom movement? Or will you just go on trying to establish a kingdom of your own? I'm going to invite the worship team to come back up. We're going to enter into a space of worship together. And we're gonna take communion at the end together. But as we're heading into worship, I just invite you to open up your spirit before God. Open up your posture as you sing, as you lean into these songs that we sing together, as we are connecting with the Spirit of the living God that's here among us. If you'd like to receive prayer, we'll have a prayer team available over here on this side of the room. We'll take communion at the end, so please wait on that. But I invite you to receive prayer, to worship, to stand, to engage, and to allow God to continue to speak to you this morning.